In the building call from the.
Do you want to be inside pay or?
Sure, you mean it's like tomorrow morning?
2015. Today is a public hearing on House Bill 5027, the Department of Land Conservation and Development. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing and turn it over to staff.
Good morning, members of the subcommittee. Today we're going to have a public hearing on the Department of Land Conservation and Development. DLCD is the administrative arm for the Land Conservation and Development Commission. The commission sets land use goals, and then DLCD ensures compliance of those local land use plans with those goals, as well as providing some technical assistance to cities and counties, city to county planning units for urban and rural development. DLCD also receives federal grant funding from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, for coastal zone management activities, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, for floodplain management activities. Federal transportation funds are transferred to DLCD from the Oregon Department of Transportation as other funds and used as an aid to integrating land use and transportation planning. The agency's here to describe all of their programs and go into a little bit of detail of the governor's budget proposal. In the proposal, generally falls into three categories. The first one is the continuance of ongoing programs, and that's in the current service level budget. And there's a reauthorization expansion of a couple of limited duration activities, including the Information Management Modernization Initiative, Natural Hazard Mitigation Program, and the Greenhouse Gas and Transportation Program, as well as some new and expanded governor's policy initiatives, and that includes regional solution plans, a coordinator for the Sage-Grouse Initiative, and a Working Lands and Farms program. So in addition to those items, there was both in the agency's request and the governor's budget increase request for general fund to provide grants for local governments. So without any further delay, we have Jim Rue, who's the agency director, and we have Carrie McLaren, which is the deputy director, here to present the agency.
All right. Director Rue, please begin.
Co-chair Redfield, thank you. Carrie and I are going to pretty much do this together, so we'll be switching off from time to time. What we're proposing, and if we can look at the first slide, which is the sort of table of contents, what we would propose to do today is to give you an overview of the department and the program. Carrie will spend some time talking about the strategic plan. We'll spend a little bit of time talking about some of the accomplishments of the last biennium, and then end the day today, with your permission, with some challenges that we face and some solutions that we're proposing to that. We have timed this out so that should be somewhere around an hour. It won't take the full 90 minutes. And then it's your pleasure if we just bust on ahead, or if we want to stop there and do numbers tomorrow. It's really your call. I think we're prepared to go either way, but our suspicion is that we're going to take the better part of the session today doing these first five tasks. Agreed?
That sounds like a good plan.
Okay. So I want to start with just a little bit of an overview, and I don't mean this to be a history lesson, but just to set the stage for the program itself. Most states in the country have an environmental impact process. California certainly has one. Washington State has one. Most of those state programs began after the passage of the National Environmental Policy Act in, I think it was 1973. Oregon does not have a state environmental impact process for state projects. We clearly have to comply with NEPA for federal projects. But why do we care? Well, we care because an EIS process focuses on specific projects. So it's a project-by-project analysis. In the early 70s, this was a really vibrant conversation with the legislature in the state of Oregon about an alternate approach, and that was what became SB 100 and what became our land use system. And the difference being that instead of doing the project-by-project EIS, the approach was, let's prepare the entire state for development and protection of critical natural resources. Let's make sure that every community in the state of Oregon has planned for jobs and housing and transportation and infrastructure. Let's make sure that they're ready to grow. And then they don't have to stop when a new project comes along. They've already planned for it. And at the same time, obviously, protecting working farms and forests and natural amenities of the state. So that in a capsule, is the planning program. That's what we have, is an alternative to an EIS. But it only works with the second part of the program, and that is, as Mr. Stainer referred to, the general fund grants program. If we don't give money to communities to do their own planning and to chart their own future, then the program begins to fail. And so I just ask that you think about that as we go through the conversation this morning about how the two of them are required in order for this program to work to its full capacity. We're going to take a look at some slides, but I just also want to point out to you, and this is sort of my pet peeve, I don't think this is DLCD's planning program. I think it's the state of Oregon's planning program, and again, it only works when all of the other agencies of state government participate, and we'll see the extent to which they do. And then the last thing I want to say as overview is that this program has, for most of its nearly 42-year history, been very process-oriented. It is a program that is structured on and driven by legal process and the statutes and regulations that come out of that. And sometimes people would ask the question of us, how's it working? Well, historically, sometimes we didn't know because we were minding the process and not paying enough attention to on-the-ground results. We are making a very strong and intentional move to bring GIS data, geographic information system data, directly into our decision-making processes so that there is a feedback loop that said, yep, that worked, no, that did not, this is how we need to adjust things to make sure that we're getting the outcomes that we need. So sort of twin messages, focus on outcomes and focus on data to help us inform the process to make sure that we continue and improve on those outcomes. So that's just the overview. This slide begins to talk a little bit about planning and what it can mean beyond just that process. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but you might reasonably ask, well, why do you have human health up at the top? Well, the reason is that if we're planning viable, vibrant communities, people are out moving more than they are in sort of old-style sprawl communities. They're walking, they're biking, they're looking at alternate forms of transportation. That means generally improving health. The rest of the stuff we've talked about, but the really important ones for us are economic development, environmental quality, housing, and protection of farm and forest. So let's move on. So this sort of repeats it, but it repeats it in a way that that lays it out in the form of mission. Our mission for the state of Oregon is to help communities plan and to make sure that when they do that planning, it's just not a static once-in-time practice, but that those plans evolve, they're sustainable, they help make sure that that community stays strong and vital. And then the last bullet, obviously, this whole program came together 42 years ago with the alliance of agriculture and forestry along with the environmental advocacy community, because working farms and forests are the key to making sure this state remains healthy and strong. Mr. Stainer talked a little bit about the department as staff to the commission. What you see in front of you, a couple of bullets, four divisions within the agency: planning, community services, coastal, and administrative, roughly 57 FTE. We'll show you a map in a second. This program, because it works with all 242 cities and 36 counties, has always been built with an emphasis on field presence, being close to the communities that we work with. So we have that regional presence. And then LCDC. And I'm not going to introduce all seven to you, but to give you a notion, on the far left, Bart Eberwein is Executive Vice President with Hoffman Construction in Portland. Bart builds big buildings all over the world. In the middle is Greg McPherson. Greg is a lawyer in Portland, but his dad, Hector McPherson, was one of the original sponsors of SB 100. Robin MacArthur on the far right worked in Oregon state government for a long while, including land use and transportation advisor to Governor Kitzhaber back in the 90s. She also worked for Matt Garrett as his policy advisor at ODOT, and 2 years ago she retired as director of planning at Metro. And we'll get to, again, Mr. Stainer talked about statewide planning goals. There are 19 of them. They tend to clump, but goal one is one that we'll be talking about a lot, and that is citizen involvement. How do we get and maintain the community voice in all of these planning decisions? Three and four, protecting farm and forest land. 9, 12, 9 through 12, and 14 are those that are focused almost exclusively on creating vibrant cities with jobs and housing and infrastructure, and then 15 through 19 focus on our coastal program. And we'll talk a little bit more about those. These are where our offices are today. Roughly 60% of the staff, maybe slightly less, is in Salem. The rest of them are co-located with four other agencies. And you've talked to enough people now that I'm sure you know that in the regional solutions system around the state, the five co-located agencies are ODOT, Business Oregon, Housing, DEQ, and ourselves. And then DSL, and you heard from Mary last week, DSL has one, perhaps two statewide staff, but they don't live in the regions the way that the other five of us do. So if you'll think about each of these spots, you'll realize that each of them also is a part of the Oregon educational system, the higher ed system. They are intentionally located within or usually on university campuses, so that we're combining focus on the region with educational support from the former OUS system. So LeGrand, to make the point incredibly obvious, is on the campus of Eastern Oregon University. And then just to reinforce the point, we've had a strong presence in the field for as long as the agency's been around. My personal experience with that was that I was relatively new to the agency in 2009 when we were preparing our budgets for the upcoming biennium in the midst of the recession. And we had to make some cuts. We had to make big ones. And we made them in the director's office and in Salem rather than touch the people in the field because in our mind they're kind of sacrosanct. And that work is important. So the next slide simply shows that not only do we spend some time working with communities during our regular daily work, but this is a slide from a long weekend trip out to Mitchell a couple of years ago to help them spruce up the downtown, some painting and some repair to buildings. And it was, I think, pretty great for everybody involved. Okay, we talked a little bit about goal one, citizen involvement. This is one, candidly, where I won't say we're struggling, but we're certainly undergoing a change. And that is, what does citizen involvement mean when we're not trying to advance goals and come up with new goals? So we're working through that. We're trying to figure out what citizen involvement means in an electronic age. But we've also talked about the fact that we work with all these cities and counties. And the next slide simply points to the fact that we have state agency coordination agreements with all of these state agencies. We renew them on a regular basis so that they are up to date and fully functional. And then the next slide, very quickly, just to set the context with the governor's initiatives. Richard was in here well over a month ago talking to you about the governor's initiatives. Our work comes primarily under the first bullet of working farms and forests and the last one under regulatory alignment and doing capacity development, particularly in rural communities, and we'll talk about that a lot more later. So Carrie's going to take over for a few minutes and talk about strategic planning.
So one slide here, I think you all did, for just sort of background, receive a copy in your budget materials of our strategic plan, and I didn't want to be repetitive with that. But I wanted to spend a few minutes to talk about why we did a strategic plan over a longer horizon. It's an 8-year strategic plan to align to the 10-year plans from the governor's office, and then what we hope to get out of it, and then a little bit about what is inside of it. So again, to get to some of the outcomes that Jim spoke about earlier. The first bullet point, I think, makes it clear. It's to provide a clear direction over a longer planning period. Many of the initiatives and projects that we have take much longer than 2 years or 4 years to lift and really prepare in a meaningful way. And as a consequence, we needed a framework to be able to set what those projects would be. An example that I think we're seeing play out now that I would give to you is that in 2010, about almost 5 years ago, Richard, then Director Whitman, and Jim started an urban forum to talk with stakeholders, which included obviously local governments, but also the development community, the conservation community, the Farm Bureau, forest interests, about how we could improve the process for urban growth boundary evaluation and expansion. And that urban forum resulted in two packages to the legislature in 2013, House Bill 2253, which concerned population forecasting, and House Bill 2254, which was a proposal for an extensive rulemaking endeavor to streamline the urban growth boundary process. Pleased to sort of remind everyone that with that broad stakeholder support that we had, we also received broad legislative support, and both packages passed both houses of the legislature unanimously. Where are we now with that process? Portland State University, through its Population Research Center, will be issuing the first set of coordinated population forecasts for one-third of the state this June. And they will continue that for the next 2 years until we have the whole state updated. Then the process that we have calls for them to continue those on a 3 to 4 year cycle. What does that mean for communities? It means that communities have updated population forecasts, which really are the foundation for much of their community planning, also the foundation for some of their economic development planning, and certainly the foundation for their public facilities founding. So foundation and planning. I think important on the ground delivery that we achieved by taking a long view. That's one of the goals that we intend to have by virtue of a longer planning period. Another example I would say on the resource side, and I think that many of you in your service on other committees have heard concerns about the phrase of internal conversion of farmland, a sort of a increasing number and types of non-farm uses that are allowed in farm zones and in some cases forest zones, and concern that those either conflict with ongoing commercial agricultural practices or that they indeed actually take some of that land out of production. That's the kind of project that takes a longer view. We have that on our strategic plan now, but we really need to call the time, space, and funding priority for that, and it's reflected in part in the Working Farms and Forests Initiative. So that's a little bit about that sort of clearer direction. I think the second point is clearer priorities. We have, as Jim referred to, we work with all 242 cities, all 36 counties. We get considerable input from stakeholder interests, whether we're talking about the home builders or the Farm Bureau or the League of Women Voters. And there are a lot of asks that those communities make of us. There's no way that we can meet them all. We have to do some sense of triage and priority setting. And so we do that. But a large part of our work really is, I will say, that reactive work that's really led in reaction to proposals that are put forth by local governments. It can come in a couple of different forms. That comes in the form of a local government asking us for some technical assistance or planning assistance on a new endeavor that they want to undertake, maybe updating an economic opportunities analysis or a transportation system plan. It can come also in the form of them submitting a plan, an updated plan to us that we need to review for compliance with the statewide planning goals. It can also come to us in the form of requests for general fund grants to actually assist financially that work at the local level. Oftentimes, I will say, we have all three of those in a particular element. But there's a portion of our work that we really try to carve out to be proactive. And the areas in which we try to be proactive is maybe it's an issue of a state priority. Certainly a state priority continues to be economic recovery, in this case particularly focusing on rural communities, but also in past legislatures, reduction in greenhouse gases. So we carve out some of our time to work on those. Some of our needs are research-based. I referred to the farm conflicts study before, so we have those types of needs. And others require improving subject matter expertise, an area we're trying to focus on more with communities, providing community development, enabling communities to actually realize the comprehensive plans that they have in place that set the vision for their communities. So what our strategic plan, therefore, really attempts to do is to describe our core work and set aside that core work some priorities for either research or development of new programs or streamlining of existing rules and regulations to help communities achieve their community outcomes and to help the state achieve its priorities. So I think pretty clearly our goal in this strategic planning process is enhanced outcomes. And I think that's both enhanced outcomes in terms of greater realization of our statewide planning goals and also doing a better job of getting there. I would say the final sort of rollout of how we're using our strategic plan is we're going through a process of a performance management system with a consultant with Mass Ingenuity that the department is starting right now. And that process will give us actually outcome indicators so that we know how we're doing both with our processes and on the ground. It's something that's reviewed on a quarterly basis. And so with this strategic plan, that performance management system, I think we have a clearer set of our direction and our measurable outcomes. That leaves me with a little bit of talking about what. What does the strategic plan actually contain in terms of our goals? Again, as I said before, the intent of the strategic plan is to combine our statewide planning goals, our legislative direction, and describe how we achieve those outcomes and how we achieve those outcomes within some of our core deliverables of technical assistance and planning assistance. So our first goal is really collapsing the natural resource goals. The goal is to conserve Oregon's natural resources, that productive farm and forest lands and coastal, scenic, unique, and other natural resource lands are planned and managed to provide a healthy environment and sustain Oregon's communities and economies. And if I was, again, to pick out an example of one of the pieces we have as a new strategy, it is to work on these non-regulatory methods, including implementing more fully a program for transfer of development rights so that we're able to protect those productive farm and forest lands that are the base of so many rural communities' economy, and also provide some very meaningful natural resource outcomes. Our second goal is to promote sustainable, vibrant communities. And that's really an articulation of those development goals that Jim spoke to before. Goal 9, which has to do with economic development. Goal 10, which has to do with provision of affordable housing for a variety of types. Goal 11, provision of efficient public services. Goal 12, efficient delivery of transportation services and multimodal transportation services. And then goal 14, which is the framework around which we do our urban growth boundaries and actual urbanization. But our goal there is really around creating and developing sustainable and vibrant communities. The project that I talked about with respect to streamlining the urban growth boundary process and the population forecast, those nest very clearly in terms of the types of new strategies that we have in this plan, because those actually deliver more efficient outcomes on the ground for communities who are growing. Another area that I would pick up there in terms of a state focus is completing the scenario planning to meet the state's greenhouse gas reduction targets, and also to increase the funding available for general fund grants so that communities can do the planning in their communities. Goal 3 of our strategic plan is to engage the public and stakeholders in Oregon's land use planning program. Again, that really works with the part that picks up on a part that Jim talked about in terms of how do we help local government, how do we help communities become engaged in a meaningful way in their community planning process? And indeed, how do we engage them in a meaningful way in the work of our commission and our department? A baseline ethic of Oregon's statewide land use planning program is that community focus. New times in terms of technologies call for new strategies. We look at working with our Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee, which is really actually a set of now professionals in this field, to help develop some toolkits that can be used by both the departments and perhaps at the local level to enable communities to have those resources available to engage their community members. Goal 4, provide timely and dynamic leadership to support local and regional problem solving. Certainly, our program has always been networked. It has relied in a partnership with local governments to do the on-the-ground planning and indeed actually do the actual permitting of development projects. But that's increasingly important as local resources are more constrained. It's increasingly more important as more of our planning is done at a regional basis. It's increasingly more important as we as a state try to align our state resources between state agencies to achieve these outcomes. And so that is a primary focus of the department in their strategic plan. And as an example of a new strategy under there is improving our ability to distribute geospatial data to local governments. The data we use to reflect whether our planning processes and our procedures are working well, how can we push that out for utilization by local governments? How do we make it meaningful for them? And we actually have a local government advisory committee who assists us in that endeavor. And then finally, goal 5 is really a business goal. As a department, we strive to deliver services that are efficient, outcome-based, and professional. This means investing in our staff so that they have the expertise that they need in order to provide communities with competent technical assistance. And it means creating an environment where we are able to evaluate the performance of our employees and support their work. So that, in a nutshell, is our strategic plan. I had an aim of getting this into 10 minutes. I just about made it. I also had an aim of getting this into about 6 pages. We didn't quite get that there. But as I presented it to some of our local government partners, a comment that I appreciated receiving was, it's nice to see the department's current work and future work reflected in something that maybe isn't exactly a layperson read, but somebody who's engaged can tell what you're doing and where you're going and what your priorities are, so that they want to have a conversation with us about adjusting them. They have a basis to do that. And that's the last part I guess I would leave you with, is this is intended to be a living document. Our commission will review it with input from the department every 2 years, more frequently if needed, and our it's really the structure by which we do our work. But we are not so clairvoyant that we know exactly what the next 8 years will bring us, and so we need a plan that provides that guidance and direction, but actually also the flexibility to make adjustments as new competing priorities come to us. So that's where I would leave the strategic plan.
So Carrie and I can be power talkers, and we've been doing that for now 29 minutes and 43 seconds. Are there any questions?
Please continue.
You lost your chance. Okay.
Well, they never lose a chance.
Yeah, we're sorry about that.
So Senator Hansel is a rough person to deal with. So we.
Yeah, we're aware. okay, so. Now we're going to move into some of the outcomes and accomplishments. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this slide because most of it is review, but we really tend to want to focus on formally capital letters regional solutions, but also small letter regional solutions, that is, making sure that the answer fits the people in a particular part of the state. And I'm not going to go into the formal structure of the Regional Solutions Program and Systems, because I think you've probably heard about it, but we are strong advocates and actively involved in those 11 regional solutions centers around the state of Oregon.
Actually, I do want to interrupt you, as I promised, Senator Hansel.
Yes,
I have a question. I was just thinking back on your slide of your commission members. Mm-hmm. I believe you have one from each congressional district. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Who is the one that's in Greg Walden's district, where my district is?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Hansel, Catherine Morrow. Lives most of the year in Bend. She's a retired planning director for Deschutes County, and she covers central and eastern Oregon. I say she spends most of the year in Bend. She and her husband are both retired from their original vocations, and they work in a smoke tower just outside of John Day every summer. But it is Catherine.
I've had some folks express an interest in serving in that capacity. Mm-hmm. What would be the way that their names would best be forwarded?
Senator Hansel, either directly to us, to Carrie or me, or to the governor's office. We do not expect a vacancy now for another 2 years. Greg McPherson will be finishing his second four-year term in just about exactly 2 years, and so we will be looking for somebody then. Commissioner Dan Schoen from Lake County has told us of his interest, and we think very highly of him, and we would be really interested in having that conversation. I will also say that we have a local officials advisory committee who meet with Carrie and me on a roughly 6 times a year basis. And Commissioner Givens, Larry Givens, is on that committee. And a new member from your part of the world is Mark Davidson, commissioner from Union County. So those guys can be direct input and access as well.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, let's skip through this slide, and we'll skip through the next one as well, because we've talked about the two primary aspects of the program. What I want to do is move on to the next slide that talks about working farms and forests. This is obviously critical to what we do. I can spend some time talking about ag and forestry contributions to the state, but Katie Koba's been here already, and nobody talks about ag better than Katie. And I'm pretty sure, I don't know that you've heard from Doug yet, but Doug Decker, I think, is going to be here in a couple of weeks. And again, I'm not going to try to do what they do way better than I do. But the point is that, I'm from a third-generation farm family, and one thing you'll never hear is a farmer talking about the good year they had last year. In fact, every year is worse than the one just passed. But the fact of the matter is that ag is, for the most part, doing very well in the state of Oregon. But there are some threats, and there are some concerns. And one of those concerns, interestingly, is fragmentation of working lands. And that is true for both ag and forestry. Many of you perhaps know, but we don't have private industrial forest lands that are owned by integrated forest products companies much anymore. A perfect example is out in Northeast Oregon, what was Boise Cascade, about 1.5 million acres, is now owned by the John Hancock Insurance Company. They may have different goals. They may have different exit strategies than would Weyerhaeuser, for instance. We're finding the same thing beginning to happen in productive ag land, is that insurance companies and retirement funds are beginning to buy up tracts of ag land. That is not necessarily a bad thing, but it does raise some challenges about how we manage our own lands for our own Oregonian purposes, and so we are concerned about those trends. Those trends are happening in part because, and I'll refer to Dave Chen, some of you may know, a venture investor who has begun to diversify his portfolio of investment, and in fact has said that the only thing he's investing in anymore is ag land. Because Dave believes that agriculture and forestry in Oregon today are where microelectronics was in the Silicon Valley 15 and 20 years ago. He believes that that's where we're headed. Why? Because as other parts of the world warm and become inhospitable to agriculture, Oregon, particularly Western Oregon, has a comparative advantage in terms of projections of future warming, simply because there's a big heat sink, the Pacific Ocean, just off to our left, and that we will have a comparative advantage in a warming world, and that food and fiber will be critical to that. So we're taking those things very seriously and trying to work through how we keep those lands in productive ag and forestry. Next slide talks about another part of the world that we're working on a lot, and that is, and forgive the fourth stray bullet there, the third one is meant to be coastal hazards and adaptation plans. There probably is no part of Oregon that is experiencing the effects of a warming world more than is the coast. And so we're working with our federal partners to work on a couple of very big projects. One of them is the Tsunami Land Use Guide. Copy of it here. It's on our website. It is the first attempt, and it was produced just about a year ago. It is the first attempt to help local communities begin to think about the effects of a Cascadia event off the coast and the resultant tsunami. beginning to think about critical infrastructure, beginning to think about where people live and work, how they get between those areas. And so our next step is to begin to apply some of the general fund grant money that we asked you for to actually get planning grants to those communities so that our coastal staff, who's already coming up with sort of best practice, can actually get in with model codes and begin to help people do the day-to-day planning that we hope will not only save lives but make communities more resilient and responsive to the post-trauma rebuild. And Neskowin is another example of that. I'm going to betray not only the fact that I'm a third-generation Oregonian, but that I'm really old, and that when I was in high school, we used to go to Neskowin a lot, and it had this incredibly big, broad, expansive beach. Representative Gomberg knows that that's not necessarily the case anymore. The shoreline there is shifting rapidly. And with that comes some really negative effects on the bluff, on the sand dune, where people live in some really expensive homes. If you've been out there lately, compared to 40 years ago, when I was hanging out there, the beach is very narrow. And the sand dunes have been pushed back a long ways, and today they're armored in riprap to prevent that. We've been, to prevent further erosion, we've been working with Tillamook County. I hope that Mark Labhart is able to at least send a letter in during public testimony to talk about this particular project. Tillamook County commissioners unanimously passed an effort to start building an adaptation plan, not only for the city of Neskowin, but essentially for that entire stretch of the coast up to Cape Kiwanda and from basically Cascade Head up to Cape Kiwanda, so that communities can begin to plan. It's been a rough last 30 years. They're expecting that the future is going to be the same or worse. So just another example of working with local communities. And I'm going to actually stop my portion with the next slide, moving to the other side of the world, to Senator Hansel's side of the world, Sage Grouse. I'm sure others have talked to you about this, but we have spent a lot of time, and we're spending much more right now, working on so-called SageCon, Sage Grouse Conservation Plan, with federal partners and state and local partners. Richard Whitman has actually been co-chair of SageCon with the Oregon State Director of the Bureau of Land Management. We're actually beginning rulemaking, have begun rulemaking. The Rulemaking Advisory Committee met for the first time last week. And if I could channel Judge Grasty from Harney County for a moment, the judge would say that Goal 5 of Oregon's land use planning system is our surest and strongest element of a plan, of a state plan, to prevent listing of the bird. What we need to have are enforceable provisions in place so that U.S. Fish and Wildlife feels as though there are consequences if things go badly. And Goal 5 does that. Goal 5 protects natural resources. We're not talking about preventing development in eastern Oregon. What we are talking about doing is protecting wildlife habitat and then working very hard to get invasives under control. You all have heard about cheatgrass. You all have heard about juniper. But between the two of them, they are destroying habitat at a prodigious rate, and we need to do something to fix it. And our rulemaking will give us a basis for getting that work underway. And I'm going to stop there because, again, I've taken longer than I intended. And so Carrie's going to talk a little bit about some numbers.
Yeah, so this gets a little bit into some data. I guess we'll say as a frame in terms of background, this slide sort of reflects the reason why we work with local communities, updating their public facilities plans, their transportation plans, assuring that housing is located in places where people have accessibility to transit, to other forms of transportation, and why we really look at a program that is focused on building both compact and livable communities. This is a somewhat dated study that was done by the Brookings Institution, but comparing basically the costs of growth from an infrastructure perspective depending upon the efficiency of land. So at the low density, 2.1 dwelling units per acre, which is about half acre lots, fairly sparsely populated, to moderate density of about 5.5 dwelling units per acre, think about 8,000 square foot lots, actually larger than your sort of standard city lots. And we see that the provision of public services in the more sort of sparsely developed areas are cost about 2.5 times more. In a time of constrained resources and probably increasingly constrained resources as the federal government puts less money into infrastructure development, this is really a key for communities to think about how they're providing those public services. So the example, if we think about what does this mean to Oregon and how are we doing vis-a-vis that sort of public purse in terms of infrastructure, and granted it's a second-hand or a second-tier analysis of it, but if you look at the population growth in the United States between 82 and 1997, which is sort of the specter of when this was in part done, the U.S. population grew by 17%. Oregon outpaced that growth by 20%. And yet our utilization of new, previously undeveloped lands, you know, natural resource lands, farm and forest lands, was far, far less than in the rest of the nation as a whole. That speaks to a more efficient delivery of public services and also farm and forest land protection and other benefits. But really, the part we want to make here is this connection with our provision of getting lands online. And we'll talk about this a little bit more tomorrow, but it's one thing to have land zoned for development. It's another thing to have the public facilities there and available for that land to be put to service, and that's why this connection with public infrastructure planning and costs really matter. If you're looking on yours, we got our slide slightly reversed. This is the one that should be there. It's another sort of look at land efficiency in a more updated fashion. So this is looking at the last census data that we have, and it compares the population growth with the increase in land area and the resulting change in population per square mile. And again, sort of the take-home message is that Oregon's population per square mile, our efficiency of the number of people we put on newly developed land, is better than our neighboring states. We talked just right now about the infrastructure, the fact that makes infrastructure provision less costly. It also makes more compact neighborhoods with more walkable areas and alternative transportation, less consumption of farm and forest land, which has some ancillary economic benefits in terms of that component of our economy, and protection of natural resource habitat. And I really think it's important. I mean, inevitably, sort of the discussion of density comes up here. We're really talking about efficiency. And so the part of the land use planning program talks about a variety of housing types across the spectrum. So we really are looking at efficient use of land and not just at our density metrics. Jim, I don't know if you want to talk about this or you want me to cover it.
Yeah, I'll go ahead because there's some of my favorite stories in here. First of all, the picture. Commission met in Portland but took a trip out to the Blue Heron, the former Blue Heron paper mill in Oregon City in January. And you can tell that it's January in Western Oregon because the sun is shining. this is a really exciting project, and they were quite taken with it. And I'm sure you've all have heard about it, talked about it. But it illustrates this point of working with communities particularly struggling communities to turn their economies around. And nobody has to talk about the struggles in Oregon City with the closure of the paper mills. But by working with those communities and trying to find new uses for some of those now abandoned mills, we've got a pretty exciting prospect for the redevelopment of Blue Heron. And that has been the focus of some of our general fund grant money. It has also been technical assistance provided to the local planners from Clackamas County and the city of Oregon City, and we have great hopes for this one. Generally, this focus on community development is a cooperative effort through our regional solutions program statewide. And let me just walk quickly through some of the roles. Obviously, we, as the state's planning agency, work with communities to make sure that their plans are up to date. And what that usually means for struggling communities is that they have enough employment land. And so that's where we go to work, is to make sure that that employment land is there. An example, just recently, within the last year, we've been able to add about 1,000 acres of employment land in Malheur County, roughly evenly distributed between the cities of Ontario, Nyssa, and Vail. But that's almost a so what. Just because the land is there, we get to Carrie's point about infrastructure. So we'll provide the help so that the local communities can plan for and set aside employment lands. And then Business Oregon comes in, particularly with the Infrastructure Finance Authority, and makes sure that there is an opportunity for low and no-cost loans made available to communities to get infrastructure out there. Business Oregon also obviously helps local communities in the recruitment and development of local business. So to stay on Ontario for a moment, Select Onion is a business that was open, running, had a couple of hundred really good jobs, ran into some trouble, were on the verge of closing. Not only have they decided to reinvest, but they're probably going to double the job space at that facility just north of Ontario. And so that's where Business Oregon's job development capacity came in. Obviously, on ODOT is probably the biggest infrastructure, the biggest infrastructure supplier in the state of Oregon. And they redid the Main Street in Nyssa and helped bring some new pride to a kind of rundown community. And then DEQ comes along. And again, this is fully a regional solutions approach. DEQ can come along with some of the infrastructure that they supply for clean water and cleanup of used water. So that's an example of how we're working with our sister agencies through the regional solutions teams to really focus on particularly rural community development, but community development throughout the state. And I want to just talk just a little bit about the city of Donald, a small community of, 500-600 people right here in the Willamette Valley, just north of Woodburn. Donald is an example of a lot of rural communities around Oregon in that there simply is not the capacity to begin and to guide the development process. Donald's city manager is also the planner, is also the public works director, is also the primary contact with the public, and she probably takes the garbage out on Friday nights. The point being, the city of Donald has one staff person. There are probably a couple of other people. She may drive the dump truck, for all I know. I hope you'll have a chance to meet her on Wednesday because she wants to come down to talk to you a little bit. One of our staff people, Angela Lazarian, came to Carrie and me about a year and a half ago and said, would you guys mind if I spent every Friday with Heidi in Donald helping her think about how to guide economic development in the community? And we said, you know, every Friday, that's probably a lot. And she said, oh, I do it on my own time. And we said, no, you're going to do it on our time. How about you do it every other Friday? So Angela spent every other Friday with Heidi trying to work through, beginning with some community visioning about what the community wanted to be, and then start looking for resources to help them get there. So this is a document that came out of the early days of that. It's called a Donald Design Charrette. A charrette is an architect's word for getting people to sit around in a circle and spend most of the day, as they did in Donald, talking about what their community could be, what it could look like, what they wanted to be there in terms of jobs and housing. And so this got picked up by some of the by the planning department at the University of Oregon, who spent the entire day there helping to facilitate the charrette. And also to produce this document so that there was a record of what people had done. Long story short, too long story short by the clock, the city of Donald is focused and moving and has begun street improvements, has begun to do industrial land expansion, and they're on their way. And so we've used that as the model for a concept of shared staff between Business Oregon and ourselves. We were asking actually for five positions, three of them at Business Oregon and two of them at DLCD, and we'll talk about this more tomorrow, shared with the governor's office, to do community development work in a non-regulatory way across the state of Oregon, but particularly focusing on small rural communities that just haven't been able to get the traction toward development. And I'm going to stop there. I think, Carrie, you're going to sort of do the strengths and accomplishments conclusion, and then we're either done or we have your questions.
So I guess Jim started with saying how we're sort of trying to use data and analysis to guide some of the things that we do, and I feel like I've become the data lady as we go through some of this presentation. But I think the part that we want to, I guess, leave you with is as we measure, and I'll talk a little bit about a more recent study also done by the Lincoln Policy Institute comparing us to other states, as we measure what our desired outcomes are, we're doing a fairly good job. Does not mean we don't have areas of improvements, but we also want to focus on where we are having successes, and that is in absorbing population growth using less land area, which contributes to lower public facility costs, lower transportation costs, and a benefit to the conservation and farm and forest land on our also economic side. The core of our mission is focused at this enhancing of urban and rural communities, whether we're talking about the city of Donald or the city of Oregon City, bringing to those communities planning assistance, technical assistance, grant funding, so that we can help support that community vision within the state's framework. And again, it is that part of really reflecting regional solutions with these diverse partnerships. That's where we think our strengths are in having local offices with our staff who are actually part of the community. So a bit on this, because I can't resist, on the Lincoln Policy Institute and their study, they looked at eight states, four states which what they labeled as mature or maturing programs, and those were the states of Florida, Maryland, New Jersey, and Oregon, with four states that offered Other land management approaches, Colorado, Indiana, Texas, and Virginia. So looking at, even though Oregon is probably the only state that we really say has a fully comprehensive statewide land use planning program, those first four states that I named have a pretty mature state structure, which guides some of their local planning as well. And as when Lincoln Land Institute did the study, Oregon outperformed other states with respect to land efficiency, reducing traffic congestion and development on farmland. An area that they identified where we were not achieving our goals was in the area of affordable housing, and that in the analysis there is it's not highly not reflected as a priority in the under our goal 10 as much as some of the other goals are, and therefore probably was the reason. I call that one out because partially in results to of this analysis and other conversations that are going on in the state, developing new implementation measures for affordable housing is a priority in our strategic plan. So hopefully if we measure this over time, we will see some improvements there. As I said before, land consumption per population growth increased less in smart growth states as a whole. And Oregon was actually the lowest. So Oregon had the highest population growth in already urbanized areas at 49%. New Jersey, by comparison, was 47%. And Colorado, interestingly, that offers a different sort of regulatory system, fairly successful as well, at 38%. Transportation, I think this is an important area for the state. Oregon had the smallest increase in hours of congestion and delay. So yes, we are seeing more congestion and we are seeing more traffic delay, but compared to other states, we are seeing significantly less in that area. Again, offered this as a way, so as we're sort of touting to you our strengths and accomplishments, where our attempt really is to bring this comparative analysis to how the state is doing in those subject matter areas. Jim's going to talk about our challenges, and I get the upside of presenting our solutions to those challenges.
So for the most part, we've talked about these, and I just want to go through them, not necessarily one by one, but pick out a couple of big ones. And the first one is probably the one that we're spending most time focusing on. Local governments, whether city or county, have suffered dramatically as a result of the recession. In many cases, 40 to 50% of the pre-recession staff was laid off, and is only just now in some communities being added back. But timber-dependent counties, and you've had the conversations about ONC and more broadly timber-dependent counties, have really had a hard time coming back from the recession. And that means that, among many other things, that they don't have the staffs in their planning departments, in their city and county offices, nor do they have the money to invest to make sure that they're on the road to development. And so at the same time, obviously, our planning money has been cut back dramatically. In the in the 07 budget, 8 years ago, we had roughly $1.5 million of general fund planning grant money to go directly to communities. Last session, that was down at around 500,000. So that's just the wrong direction, and hence our ask for the 500,000 add back this year. And that's money that goes directly to communities to do planning, and it's money that's sorely needed. The other thing that we've talked about a little bit is making sure that we have the data to understand what's going on out across the state, and that we look at it statewide, that we look at regional variations, that we look at variations by size and complexity of local government, and that we use that data to help inform how we work and where we work. Dependence on general fund, you all can see for yourself in the overview data that we've given you, roughly 65 to 70% of our budget comes from general fund. I keep referring to Katie and Ag, but their number is probably somewhere around 15% right now, as is the case for DEQ. We are vastly funded by general fund. They have revenue from other sources that we simply do not. And then the last point, and Carrie has talked about this, but there are not many people in the state of Oregon who wouldn't tell you that the land use system is simply too complex and it's too difficult to navigate. And so virtually everything we're doing right now is to try to address that perception. I'm not suggesting that the problems aren't real, because some of them clearly are. Hence our work on streamlining the UGB process. Hence our direct involvement in community development. Hence our work on real data to help us inform decisions that lead to the outcomes that we all want.
So our solutions, and this is a bit of a preview to what we'll be talking about more tomorrow as we get into our key performance measures, but then also the kind of meat of our budget and our policy option packages. But we see a clear need for increased technical assistance grants, and that speaks to the first two bullets on the last slide that Jim looked at. One, just diminished local capacity. We need to help meet those needs. And then increased requests for assistance that don't have anything to do necessarily or directly have something to do with a lack of local capacity, but new needs, whether it's to work on natural hazards planning about increased risk of slides or flooding or tsunami, et cetera. So we see a real need for increase in technical assistance grants. That's included, that ask of about $500,000 is included in our POP 101. For further context, I would say that we are oversubscribed in our grant application process by about three or four times. So we have three times the ask of what we actually have had had in the last biennium available. And we assume that that's actually somewhat metered by people's expectations. They know they don't have a lot of money. So we would suspect in some ways that we'll see that sort of need and interest continue to grow. Community development and regional solutions, a critical component of assisting local governments in actually implementing their plans. Long-range plans are important. Comprehensive plans are vital to creating the lay of the land, the vision for a community. But we need to do more at the state level and working with our state agency partners and other regional partners of getting over the hurdle of seeing those plans be implemented. And a lot of that focus is in the area of community development, downtown revitalization, and infrastructure provision. UGB streamlining. I'll talk tomorrow and provide this committee with some data on urban growth boundary expansions that do occur. We hear the stories of Woodburn and McMinnville that get caught. We also have a number of communities who really actually successfully use the program. But we know that we can do a better job of achieving the outcomes with more clarity for communities as they enter the process, more assurance of the standards that they need to meet, and using data that can help, comes through the statewide basis, that can help communities reach those decisions more efficiently so that they have more resources, again, to spend on getting those plans to be implemented. Natural hazards planning, whether it's with respect to flooding or slides or tsunami or erosion, this is increasingly a concern for local governments. And to talk a little bit about the way that we approach that is to work with sister agencies such as Dogami on the science. They do the what are the risks, or University of Oregon in a risk analysis. What are the risks that communities are facing? We take that analysis and work with communities to actually have their planning documents work to either adapt or mitigate those risks that they're facing. One way we do that is through the development of model codes that communities can implement. And again, it provides them a framework. They can pick and choose the components, but it provides them a framework to address those needs. That, again, is reflected in one of our policy option packages. That last point is tied into sort of how we respond to climate change. Business transformation Transformation and information management improvements, if we've hit on anything today, it's our sort of need to use GIS analysis to provide more statewide data, both for us to evaluate our own policies and processes and to push down to local governments or push out to local governments so that they can utilize it. In some cases, some communities don't have GIS systems themselves, so it means actually providing an increased level of some evaluation and support for those communities. Shared services. We, as part of our own internal business operations, are constantly and consistently looking for ways that we can work with other state agencies to reduce our costs of doing business. So one example that I would pull out is that we no longer have our own procurement contract position, but work with water resources, right? Yes, I have to remember all of our partners in these administrative functions to provide those services to us, because our needs are not enough that it really merits having a half-time staff person on that. So looking for ways that we can take those dollars then and push them out into the field for community planning. We've talked about the working lands, farms and forests part, and the sage-grouse components, and those are again reflected. So we're trying to match the needs that we see from communities and from different regions of the state with resources, both technical grants and planning assistance, to meet those needs of our community partners. I think that brings us to our close of what we planned on presenting to the committee today.
And by my stopwatch, we're at 1 hour, 9 minutes, 5, 7, 10 seconds. So we've gone a little over, but we also have time for thoughts, questions, directions for tomorrow.
So are there any questions from anyone today? All right. With that, we'll go ahead and we'll close the public hearing for today and adjourn the meeting, and we'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.